It's wonderful how the Lord opens your eyes. I hadn't noticed until I heard Mary reading, and there was that verse that spoke of them being called out of Egypt and in the wilderness. And there you saw how the Lord your God carried you as a father carries his son. I thought, that's a wonderful picture, isn't it? The Lord carried you as a father carries his son. Now that could be a whole another sermon, but that's not my sermon today. But isn't it wonderful as we read the scriptures how at different times and at different ways God will bring things to our attention? Our God is a good God. So our theme today is second time around, looking at Deuteronomy. We're beginning a series in Deuteronomy. If I was to do a survey among you and ask what is your favourite book in the Bible, then I very much doubt that you would answer Deuteronomy. I may be wrong, but I don't think it would even make the top three, or maybe even make the top 10. And while it may not be our favourite book, Jesus quoted it so often that one scholar says, judging by the number of quotations from Deuteronomy, this was Jesus' favourite book. When Jesus was tempted by Satan, he quoted Deuteronomy back to Satan as his defence. The book contains the Shema, the most important and central prayer in the... Thank you. Just seemed to fade away there. The Shema. So the most important and central prayer in the Hebrew for the Hebrew people, which Jesus confirmed to be the great commandment. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And it also speaks of Israel being God's chosen people, saying, for you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. And there's also a promise in this which speaks of the Messiah who would be a prophet like Moses. And we read, I will raise up from them a prophet like you, like Moses, from among their brothers. And I will put my words in his mouth and he will tell them everything I command him. So that Jesus was able to say to the people of his day, if you believe Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. And it brings us a challenge. Now choose life, so that you and your children may live, and that you may love the Lord your God, and listen to his voice, and hold fast to him. So, as we begin to see some of these verses that are scattered around in Deuteronomy, it becomes a little bit more clear to us how important this Old Testament book really is. Deuteronomy is relevant for Christians in every generation. However, it requires more from us than some of the other Bible books that we will read. Because it asks us to look at the ancient words, the ancient culture, and to find a bridge through into our own day and our own time and our own questions. And so we need to think about this some more. We need to be willing to think theologically about issues that aren't necessarily straightforward to us. And we need to put in a bit of effort to be able to wrestle with them and think about them. Now, the reason that I have chosen to look at Deuteronomy at this time in our church life is because I think it has some links, some relevant things to say to us in our centennial year and as we approach the celebration of our centennial. In Deuteronomy, the people of Israel were on the edge of something new. It was a new generation on the brink of going forward in faith into a new experience of God's promises. They were about to enter into the promised land, and having grown from a family and into a tribe and tribes, they became a nation. And as a nation, they were about to start a new phase of their existence. Before them lay a new land with new challenges and new opportunities. And we too stand on the edge. on the brink of something new. A new century of church life, new challenges, the possibility of a new church building, new opportunities for mission, calling a new minister, possibilities even that have not yet been revealed to us, but as we step out in faith will become obvious to us. We too are being called and challenged to step out in faith in our day. So, as a part of what we do in our centennial celebration is we look to the past and we see God's hand at work and we take comfort and we take strength from that and we see God in the present and the things that He is doing now. And because of these things, we are able then to look into the future and see what God is calling us to. God is leading us into a new experience of what it means to be God's people in a new day and a new age and among a new generation. So in a sense, we need to roll up our sleeves and be willing to work on this as we look at Deuteronomy over the next few weeks. Because it's a new series, I want to give a little bit of context. Deuteronomy, the word Deuteronomy, means second law. Second law. This is not in the sense of it being a new law, a second law where Moses gave the first law. Rather, it's a repeat of what Moses had said back then to a new generation. So the law is being reiterated the second time. The people to whom this book is written, the context in which it is spoken of, this people had been wandering in the desert for 38 years, wandering around. The older generation had died. I find this really sad. The older generation had died. They had the chance to move into the land, to receive God's blessings, but they backed away. They were fearful. They rebelled. And they ended up going round and round in circles for this 38, 40 years. And a lot of the time, they were only a stone's throw away from the promised land, yet they couldn't go into it, and they couldn't receive it. It seems to me so sad that in a sense here are 40 years wasted wandering in the desert, while this new generation grows up. And so Moses is repeating to them things that perhaps they had seen in their childhood, or some of them hadn't even been born, reminding them of things that their parents had experienced, perhaps even told them about. In a sense, he's saying to them, you are about to do something new, and it's going to be really challenging. And in order to do this, you need to look back. You need to see what God has done for your parents, for the previous generation. You need to look at that story of salvation from slavery in Egypt and see the way the Lord your God was with you, because that will be a strength and that will be an encouragement as you step out to face these new challenges. Instead of sort of going round and round in circles where there's not much happening, not much of a challenge, now you're going to step out and be facing something that's really going to ask some questions of you and really put you to the test. And to be able to go forward, then you need to be able to look back and build on these promises that God has given the previous generation, so that you can find the faith to step out and trust God in your generation. And so the context of this as well is that the book contains some narrative story based around three significant sermons given by Moses. The people are about to enter into the land, but sadly, Moses isn't going with them. At the end of this book, Moses dies. He knows he's not going into the promised land. And so he wants to give to these people some parting remarks, some parting comments that can set them up so that they can thrive in faith when he is no longer with them. A time of parting tends to focus the mind and the heart on the issues that are really important. I have moved on from two parishes. I spent 5 years in Pukerau Waikaka Valley near Gore, and also at Te Huna Nui in Nelson. And there came a time in both of those parishes where I knew and the people knew I was leaving. And it really does something in the heart and the mind of a minister when you know you're leaving. I had grown to love those people. I had a real sense of spiritual care for those people. And so I wanted to be able to leave something with them that would be helpful and useful to them. I wanted to remind them of the journey we had been on, give them hope for the present day, and give them encouragement as they set out into the future. This is not uncommon when a person is leaving. And perhaps if you have had to leave some people, you may have wanted to impart to them something that would help them into the future. And so it's quite common, not unexpected, to see that Moses is doing the same thing through these sermons. And you can sense his deep and abiding pastoral care for these people. Now, I'm not talking about my parishes here, but Moses, these people had just frustrated him. They had really gotten under his skin. Some of the things that they did made him tear at his hair. That they would do these things when they knew what God was calling them to be and to see. And yet, when you read Deuteronomy and his sermons, you get this sense of his love for them. You also get the sense he was really frustrated that he wasn't getting into the promised land because of all the stuff that had gone on. But he wants to remind them of who God is and how much they can trust God. One scholar, Daniel Block, cleverly calls Deuteronomy the gospel according to Moses. I think that's really clever. The gospel according to Moses, because Moses is giving them the good news for their generation. And this is a book that's full of amazing grace, in which a family of no real distinction is called to represent God among the nations. And they're about to be given incredible gifts of grace from the hand of God in a land full of milk and honey, a land where they could thrive as they walked with God and be an example to the nations so the nations could be drawn to know God. This is a message that is so filled with God's grace. Moses' sermon begins in chapter 1 at verse 5, and he recaps what happened over the 40 years earlier when they had the opportunity to enter the promised land. And the message again filled with such grace: "See, I have given you this land. Go in and take possession of the land that the Lord swore he would give to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to their descendants after them." You see, this was a people who had been slaves, mistreated by their Egyptian masters. They had nowhere to call home. They had no free will. They had to do what was dictated to them. And their masters in Egypt worked them ruthlessly. And their numbers growing was seen as a threat to the people in Egypt. So the Egyptians commanded that the male children of the Israelites be put to death. But God had plucked them out of that situation and miraculously called them and commanded them and made them to be a people and brought them to this place, the promised land. They didn't deserve it. They couldn't earn it. It's a gift of grace. It's a fulfillment of the promise that God had given to Abraham. And so they sent spies into the land to see what it was like and what lay ahead of them. And they came back, and in summary, they gave their report: "This is a good land. It's a good land that the Lord our God is giving us. It's a good land." But they didn't enter it. They were afraid. They rebelled. And so they spent this time wandering in the desert. And much of that time, no more than a stone's throw from the promised land, going round and round in circles. I wonder if you feel at times your life is going round and round in circles. And why is it going round and round in circles? Will you not enter in to what the Lord has called you to? And so they were going round in circles and getting nowhere for 40 years, but that had passed, and now their children. And remember in the scripture it said they were worried that their children would be taken slaves and taken captive that 40 years ago. But now these children had grown up. Now these children were adults. Now these children were the ones who were going to go and enter in, while the adults had passed away in the desert. The next generation were on the edge of the promised land. But even in these opening words, we find one of the real problems for the modern reader. This promised land already had inhabitants. And particularly we're reading about the Amorites. Now when we come to this and we read about it, something to bear in mind is this. If you read it through, you'll see there are about five different people groups, and God says to them, don't go into their land. Don't touch it. I've given it to them. Don't go into this other group's lands. Don't touch it. I've given it to them. You can walk through this land, but don't take any of that land. Not even one footprint are you to take from that. And if you go through that land and you use some of the resources, you've got to pay for it. You've got to pay the people of the land for the resources that you take. Don't touch them. Don't make war against them. Don't take any of their land. There were so many people groups that God was blessing, that God had called. But the Amorites were different. The Amorites was a term used for inhabitants of Canaan. A number of tribal groups, including the Hittites and the Perizzites, many of whom lived in the hill country of the Promised Land. They were a nomadic desert people, and over time they had settled in Canaan. And many of these people would be killed as the people of Israel went forward and fought against them and drove them out of the land. Our modern term for this wholesale slaughter of a group of people is genocide. And from our perspective, we wonder how God could allow this, let alone command that all the people of this group should be put to death. I'm sure many of us have been at Bible studies at some time, and we've ended up puzzling about this. How does this work? Or perhaps some of your non-Christian friends have challenged you. How can you follow a God who has said these things in the Old Testament? Well, the first thing to note about this is the matter is complex, and there are no fully satisfying answers to this. We might say God doesn't have to explain himself to us. He's God. He has reasons for things that are unknown to us and presently unknowable for us. And while it's true God doesn't need to explain himself to us, that doesn't help us in terms of understanding what's going on here. However, what I say, whatever answer you may be able to find for this, is going to be in part, well, inadequate, partial at best. But there are some clues in the Bible about this. Later in Deuteronomy, we read, it is on account of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is going to drive them out before you. It's not because of your righteousness or your integrity that you are going in to take possession of their land, but on account of the wickedness of these nations, the Lord your God will drive them out before you. And the reason for the annihilation of this people is their great, great wickedness. Their wickedness is described in Leviticus 18, and it includes all manner of sexual perversions, of child sacrifice, of idol worship. Ancient Jewish writings about this say that they were the most evil, sinful nation whose wickedness surpassed that of all the other nations. And God was using the people of Israel as they went into this land to bring judgment on this sinful people. But it was not a hasty judgment. As we read in Genesis 15, God said to Abraham, in the fourth generation of your descendants, they will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. The sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. God saw the sin of the Amorites at Abraham's time, and yet he allowed them another 400 years of grace before bringing judgment upon them. We don't know how God might have tried to reach these people, to turn them around in their sin, but we do know that their sin continued to grow. It may not rest easy with us, but our God is a God of judgment, a just and patient judge who is not quick to anger but is quick to forgive, but a judge nonetheless. And God does bring judgment on people and will not allow sin to continue unpunished. We see this judgment in the story of Noah, where only one family survived. We see this judgment in the Pharaoh, who chased after the people of Israel with his armies and who were destroyed as the Red Sea closed in around them. We may feel uneasy about God's judgment, But there are times, and perhaps even today, when we ask why God does not intervene and bring judgment on people, such as those who are part of ISIS with their barbaric treatment of people. It is beyond imagining how you could gather the people of a town in a stadium and bring other people into the midst and put them to death in front of others. Their reign of terror with beheadings and rape and murder and so many atrocities. And we find ourselves in some ways questioning God's judgment, and on the other hand, wanting God's judgment to come on those who would behave in such a way. All this serves to remind us that there will be a judgment day when humanity, all humanity, stands before the throne of God. And so in Deuteronomy, there is a sense of urgency here because judgment is coming on the Amorites. But the people of Israel are also reminded, if you follow their ways, if you follow the ways of the people of the land, you also will be judged. And God says to them, choose life. Here are blessings. Here are curses. Choose the blessings. Choose life. And he sets out these covenant promises to the people of Israel as he holds them out to us. And he says, what does the Lord your God ask of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I am giving you today for your own good. For your own good. These were good commandments. These were commandments that would bring them blessings, that would enrich them, that would enable them to grow and thrive. And so also then there is a sense of urgency for us in our day to choose life, to follow Jesus, to obey God. If we continue to rebel in sin, if the people of our age will not respond to God's love, then they will face God's judgment. Talking about God's judgment isn't easy. But I thought I'd best talk about it today, because as we delve into Deuteronomy, we see it there so plainly. And what will we do? Will we stand aside from it or ignore it? Of course not. We don't fully understand it. But still, we will ask the questions about it. As we think about it, though, it's a very real question for us. But in Deuteronomy, it's not the big issue. God has prepared a wonderful grace for people as they enter into the promised land. And this is what Moses is talking about and reminding them of. So what difference does this make to us? Well, God brought them around a second time around, a chance to enter the land. And through these sermons that Moses preaches to them, they are given hope and encouragement. They are reminded that God has done miracles on their behalf, freeing them from Egypt, leading them by fire and by cloud, giving them the Ten Commandments. And so now again they are on the brink, they are on the edge, they are on the verge of entering in, just a footstep away from entering in to something new. What would they do with their opportunity? And we also stand on the edge of a new century of church life. On the brink, on the verge of something new. On the 4th of July in 1915, Greyfriars Church, Mount Eden Presbyterian Church, as it was known then, met for the first time, just down the road in Windmill Road. It was an evening service. And the response to the three-month trial, they thought, we'll try it for 3 months and see what happens. The response to the three-month trial just let them know there was a strong desire, a clear need for a church to be built in this area. You know, there is still a need for a church in this area. There is still a need for a Christian people to be talking, to be walking the faith, and to be sharing the faith with the other people of our community. And they knew that. It was only a matter of months when they first started out before they had 180 people worshiping. And in 5 weeks' time, we'll celebrate that centennial of the first service. And at that time, and throughout this year, we're looking back and we're remembering, we're celebrating all that was happening through all of those years as God walked with the people in this place. And then we look to the future, because we're on the brink of this new century of church life, facing new challenges, facing changes in our modern society. And the question is, will we step out in faith? And will we allow God to use us to extend his kingdom in our day? Will we have the faith of those who serve God in this church through World War I, through the Great Depression, through World War II, whose faith brought them again and again to try and not just to worship God, but to build up a church and to feed into the lives of children and to be there for those who needed them? The first time the people of Israel were on the brink of stepping into the promised land, they drew back with fear. There were giants in the land. It was too difficult. They felt they had no chance. And there are giants in the land today. We face the giant of postmodernist skepticism that denies the possibility of God's existence, that puts its faith in just what humanity can do alone. And we face the indifference of many who have no time for God or church or faith. And we face the creeping tentacles of lax morality as we in our society have the ability to save premature babies and give them a good life, and yet at the same time will abort babies around that same age. In our past week, the news has been filled with questions about the right to choose your own time to die when faced with something terminal like cancer. And at the same time, there's also been a breakthrough in cancer treatment that has shown potential to cure some cancer and to extend the lives of many others. And I suppose there are many idols in this nation. A person recently erected in Clevedon, a 6.4 meter high statue of the Hindu god Shiva in his garden. Idols in our nation. Well, what will we do as we step into a new century with these new issues to face? I hope and I pray, and God willing, I will lead you into the future with faith. And I say this not with any sense of pride in who I am to do this, but because I know that God is here, and I know that God is inspiring our people, inspiring our church leaders, inspiring our elders, and because God is doing this, will lead us. I don't like meetings for meeting's sake. I could always find something better to do than have a meeting. But I find our church meetings uplifting. Those of you who were here at our planning day at the beginning of the year, you will have felt the buzz with the ideas that were being shared at that time. And those of you who are part of our ministry team meeting, coming along and discussing what the teams are doing at any given time and looking forward to the future, you know that God is involved in this and that there are wonderful things that are opening up before our church life. And today we had standing in front of us people from a new ministry that we didn't have this time last year, because God opens doors before us, and this is so good. And because our parish council, friends, you parish council are godly, godly people. And they are praying and they are seeking God's will. One of the things that we do at our parish council, I don't know if you know this, but at our parish council, we spend the beginning of our meeting always, always focused on the mission of this church. Other things that might be happening, we can talk about if we've got time. But this church and the mission that God has called us to here, these are things that we focus on straight away, and we give our good time and our best time to this. And because of this, there's a sense of momentum and direction in our mission. And we stand at the edge. We stand at the brink of a new century. We can step out in faith, secure in the knowledge that God is with us, that God is leading us, that God is with the people of our congregation, with our leaders and with our parish council. We can look forward to new things in our children's ministries. We can look forward to growth and discipleship. We can look forward to a new church building that can be a base, a springboard for our mission into the community. So let us then celebrate the past of this church, particularly honoring the faithful women and men who serve God here, who put their hearts and their souls and their effort into establishing the church and building the church and keeping the church going, making sure the gospel was being preached. And let's also enjoy the present, because God is with us today, and God is in the midst of the things that we're doing. even as we walk away from this place in a few moments, God will be with us, going with us. And as we go to work on Monday, or to school, or to the office, or wherever it is that we might be going, God will be with us and leading us through those times. God can be working and giving us opportunities to be His people, to show His love, to speak forth His goodness and His grace. And not just in the present, God gives us hope for the future. I look forward to seeing the way our church grows, the things that God is going to do in this place, the way that God will inspire us. I wonder if God is inspiring you this morning. What has God called you here to do? What is God inviting you to do as a part of our church here? What gifts has He given to you that you can use? Where are the times and the ways that you can invest into the future life of our church? One of the things that's coming up pretty soon, and I invite you to pray about this, and maybe in some way you can help, we're going to have a children's program in the holidays. We haven't done this in a long, long time. And we've found someone to lead it. And we're going to need some people to help us along the way. Maybe you have some time that you can give to that. And when Elizabeth asks, she's leading the team putting this together. When Elizabeth asks, say yes. Be a part of it. It might only be a small part. It may be helping with some afternoon tea or morning tea or whatever it is. But be a part of it and allow it to happen. Our God is so good. Our God is so good. So, my sisters, my brothers, stand strong. As we step out into the new century, stand strong. Do not let anything move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your work in the Lord is never wasted. Stand strong. Stand strong. Let's be that church that stands strong and puts our roots down even more deeply in this place. With roots so strong that perhaps God might say to us, carry, as I carry Israel like my son. Now you, in your turn, carry the people of this place. Carry them in your prayers. Carry them in your heart. Carry them to a place where they can come to know me. Stand strong. Let's pray.